How long does the change last?
It depends. Sometimes a day, sometimes less. Sometimes more.
Terin's question rumbled out, and it happened to be the very same one Anise was about to ask.
Why wouldn't he give the potion to his entire army at Blackstone? If it's as effective as you claim, they would be unstoppable. He could take Knight's End, and then nothing would be able to stop him from marching all the way to the Southron gates.
Lord Griswold is an arrogant man. He believes victory in the Bay of Bounty is a foregone conclusion, and he only has a limited supply of the potion. Darkspell had to travel deep into the hinterlands to obtain a key ingredient, some kind of brittle stone that must be ground up into a powder and mixed with underground water that has never been touched by sunlight. He only tested the potion once, on 10 of us, to conserve the supply. Supposedly he has just enough remaining for a single use for all 99 of his soldiers at Castle Hill.
Can Darkspell make more? Anise asked.
Yes, given sufficient time. And assuming he can locate more of the stone.
Anise considered all of the information, and what it might mean if it was true.
Is there anything else?
Like what?
Semetz asked. He raised an eyebrow.
Thank you, sir. You may go. Sir Dietrich will help you locate the knight's quarters and equip you as needed.
Thank you, Your Highness, Semetz said.
He bowed stiffly, turned on his heel and left, closing the door behind him.
Go with him,
Anise said to Sir Dietrich.
Anise, if I may— Though Anise is a far cry better than woman, it's still Queen or Your Highness to you, and no, you may not. Now go.
When Sir Dietrich didn't move, Anise said,
I have another boot, you know.
Sir Dietrich scurried away. Anise could see the amusement in Terin's eyes.
You are a dangerous woman, he said.
Of course she is,
Zelda said. She finished licking the bowl clean.
She's related to me.
What do you make of the knight?
Terin asked.
Anise considered the question. Like you said, he's unusual, but that doesn't make him a liar.
Darkspell is a powerful potion, master,
Zelda said.
It is not beyond the realm of possibility that he could have developed such a formula.
Then what do we do? Anise said. We can't stay in Gearhert forever, hoping my uncle will fall down the steps like my father did.
True, Zelda said. How many soldiers do we have at last count?
Over 800, but more arrive every day,
Terin answered. Word of the True Queen's claim on the crown had been flying around the kingdom by newsbearers and messengers and streams, and hundreds were descending on Gearhert to offer their support. Then again, she knew she needed to discount the number by half. Many of the newcomers were too young or too old, but Anise was in no position to deny them their right to fight for something they believed in. And yet, even if they were battle-hardened warriors, 800 was a pitifully small number compared to the 10,000 soldiers gathered at Blackstone.
My uncle's army is focused on the west. When will we ever have another opportunity to lay siege to Castle Hill?
It could be years,
Terin admitted.
But can a group of 800 ragtag fighters defeat 99 monsters?
Anise asked.
You are the queen. You decide.
Zelda's eyes glittered.
Anise knew she'd been backed into the very corner she'd been avoiding ever since she declared herself queen. She wished Archer were conscious. He'd always had a mind for strategy. She, on the other hand, had more of a mind for pummeling things until they could no longer get up. Terin, she said, hoping her paramour would bail her out.
It is your choice, Your Highness.
She closed her eyes.
Archer might never wake up. The moment she thought it, she knew what they had to do. Begin making preparations. In a week's time, we ride for Castle Hill, monsters or not.
13. The Southern Empire, Fanes. Jai Jaru. The chariot driver had been bound to Emperor Hoser. While it was possible the man had ridden back to Fenia and kept the secret of the Black Tear's attack on Garadia Mine, It was far likelier he was under strict instructions to report any unusual behaviour directly to the Emperor. And a rebel uprising was definitely in the category of unusual activity. As Jai had explained all of this to Sonika Vade, the Black Tears leader, her frown had grown deeper and deeper. "We have little time to waste," she said. Jai couldn't argue with that. He'd seen firsthand the merciless speed with which Hoza meted out his version of punishment. "We won't get far." His heart was in his gut. Without the element of stealth, their trek north would be impossible. His people were doomed. "Perhaps we shouldn't go far," Shanti interjected. The Terran rebel was standing by a cart hitched to her horse, a speckled white mare. The cart was laden with barrels that Jai assumed were not filled with food or water. "Fire root powder. Enough to blow a hole in a wall, if necessary." "Explain," Sonika said. Shanti squinted out from the cover of her long, coppery lashes. Already the sun was bright and hot, and it would only get worse as it rose toward its apex. Shanti said, "He will expect us to head toward the sea, as that's the closest avenue of escape. However, when his men don't find us, they'll circle back and cut us off to the north." "We can't exactly stay here either," Jai said, "if that's what you're suggesting." She shook her head. "No. We have to go somewhere, but not so far that we'll be left in the open." "You want us to hide?" Jai said. It was a good idea, but where could they hide thousands of slaves? "Yes, in the Black Rocks. There are safe places there. We've used them before to regroup, many times." Jai had heard stories about men searching for treasure amongst the shadowy rocklands to the northeast of Garadia. Some said the rocks were stained black by hot tar that bubbled up from narrow chutes between the boulders. Others said the dark hue was the dried blood of all those who had died amongst the rocks. Occasionally the word ghosts was used to describe the perils one would face in the area. But the stories did have one thing in common. They all ended with the treasure hunters never being seen again. Jai pictured all 5,000 of his people vanishing from the face of the earth, falling down a hole so deep they'd never reach the bottom. "It's too dangerous," he said. "Shanti's right," Sonika said. "It's less dangerous than the alternative. And anyway, we've mapped the Black Rocks. We know where to hide. You're just going to have to trust us." Jai hadn't trusted anyone but the miners of Garadia for a long time, but then again the Black Tears were trusting him, too. "Fine. But we'll have to brush away our tracks. Even the Black Rocks won't be able to hide 5,000 sets of footprints in the sand." The Black Rocks had surrounded them hours earlier, and now seemed to crowd in closer, the paths narrowing, until they were forced to traverse the rocky canyons in single file, an endless train of marching, travel-weary refugees. At the head of the train rode the members of the Black Tears, occasionally consulting a scrap of parchment with scrawled words and lines on it, a map, supposedly, though to Jai it looked more like a child's drawing. How they knew to take the third path from the left or the descending trail over the ascending one would likely always be a mystery to him. Before they'd departed from the mine, Jai had had the children collect stalks of brittle scrubgrass, which they tied into broom-like bundles, secured with bits of twine and string. The over-eager children brought up the rear of the procession, walking backwards and sweeping away the thousands of tracks in the sand. To them it had become a game, and they counted the number of footprints they swept until they were able to declare a winner. Jig had come in 12th, which he claimed he was satisfied with, though Jai could see he'd wanted to be first. The wind had done the rest, the ever-changing desert landscape moving and shifting on whisper-soft feet. Once they were firmly within the maze of the Black Rocks, they ceased the game and moved the kids back into line with their parents or other keepers. As they walked, Jai prayed to any of the gods who would listen that he wasn't leading them all to their dooms. Fortunately, the people were no strangers to hard work and harsh conditions, and they uttered no complaint, even as the sweltering sun pressed upon their backs and slung daggers of heat upon their cheeks. The men tied their hair into piles atop their heads to stay cool, while the women used sheaves of the broad-leaved carrigal plant to fan themselves. They didn't complain even when their inadequate shoes tore and fell away,
and their feet cracked and bled, nor when several of the elders collapsed and couldn't get up. They took turns carrying those who still had life in them, while they were forced to bury others in shallow graves in the dust. Vultures circled overhead as they walked, and Jai hoped the carnivorous raptors wouldn't become a beacon to the Emperor's searchers, who had likely reached Garadia by now. He also hoped the predatory beasts wouldn't attempt an attack on any of the smaller children, which they were known to do. Their talons were as long as fingers, and their powerful wings could easily lift the weight of a human, carrying them for long distances, high into their nests built on the sides of the cliffs, where no escape or rescue would be possible. Jai carried Axa for a long time, until his shoulders ached and his back was bent from the load. Sometimes he wondered why he was doing it. I could leave him amongst the rocks for the vultures, and none would care. I would care, he reminded himself, staggering onwards. I will leave no living slave under my care behind, even one who used to be a master. Thankfully, Axa began stirring just as they rounded a curve in the path. Ahead of Jai, the black tears had stopped. A brackish river burbled up from a crack in the rocks, slid smoothly past, and then dove back underground. The horses lapped at the dark water greedily. Jai gently eased the man to the ground, propping him up against a boulder. He cupped Axa's chin, tilted his head back, and dribbled what was left of his water down the man's throat. He choked once, but then swallowed the rest. "Can you walk?" Jai asked. The man blinked rapidly, and seemed to have trouble focusing. Jai wondered how much of his old life he remembered. Did he know he was a monster? Did he care? Or was he a completely different person now that he wore the slave mark around his neck?
"I can walk," Axa said. "What is your command?"
"I make no command," Jai said.
"Then I shall sit here."
"Why?"
"Because I am aimless."
Jai knew the man wasn't being intentionally difficult. Vin Hosa had given him one command, to obey me. That's all he knew. That's all he was. The entirety of his wicked life boiled down to a single goal. Without that goal, he was, as he said, aimless. Jai knew he couldn't give Axa free will like the others, at least not yet. It was too dangerous for all of them. He didn't know if Axa would revert back to the man he'd been. That monster. Still, he had to give him a chance. "You will stay with the group. You will feed and water yourself. You will survive."
"Yes, master."
"You will not call me master."
"Yes."
He remembered the mirror he'd found on the man. "Why do you have a mirror?" Jai asked.
"To remember myself," Axa said. "I knew what Emperor Hosa would do to me. I wanted to remember who I was."
"How did you get the mirror?"
"I asked for it in prison. The guards thought it was funny, so they gave it to me. They laughed at me when I stared into it for hours."
Jai hadn't really known Master Axa when he worked for him at Garadia. He hadn't wanted to know his masters, especially not this one, who'd always been particularly vicious toward the slaves. And yet, the man had surprised him with his answers. But he had one more question. "Did it work? Do you remember the man you used to be?"
"No,"
Axa said. There was no emotion in his voice. Jai felt for the mirror, pulling it out and angling it toward Axa, so he could see his own face.
"What do you see?"
"Nothing.
I see nothing."
Frowning, Jai handed him back the mirror. He walked away, filling his water skin from the gritty stream, before following the black tears deeper into the black rocks. The sun had long disappeared behind the dark cliffs. Gusts of wind charged through the narrow paths, and Jai felt as if each one swallowed him and spit him out, only to swallow him again with the next blast. He was sweaty, his lips coated with fine grains of sand, his skin filmed with black rock dust.
"Here,"
Sonika called from up ahead. Rock walls rose up on all sides, leaving only a river-like strip of darkling sky above them. The trail was so narrow that the rough walls scraped their skin away layer by layer. The horses barely fit through several sections, and required a push from behind to squeeze between the rocks. Jai strode ahead, anxious to see where, exactly, they were.
Sonika and the other Tears were peering into a hole in the rock wall. Jai looked over their shoulders, but all he could see was nothingness, a darkness so complete it was the absence of light.
"We cannot send the people in there."
Sonika twisted her head around.
"We must. The way ahead is blocked."
Jai peered down the rocky trail, which seemed to go on forever.
"How do you know?"
Shanti bumped him from the side.
"Because we blocked it."
She grinned, her teeth appearing whiter next to the absolute darkness.
"Fire root. My specialty."
Jai knew they couldn't go back, and even if he wanted to, it was a maze. In the dark, it would be impossible to navigate. Once again, he had to trust Sonika and her Tears to lead them to safety.
"We should prepare torches," he said. "We don't need them," Sonika said.
She grabbed his hand roughly and pulled it into the inky darkness. She closed his fingers on a rope.
"It's not far, and the rope will lead the way. There will be enough light there."
"There will be room for everyone."
Sonika offered a half-smirk. "You're very protective of your people, aren't you?"
Memories of those he'd lost cycled through his mind. Old Hoba with the gimpy leg, killed by a cave-in. Simona with the positive attitude, lost while exploring a new area of the mine. Wives, husbands, children, friends, countless souls.
My mother, taken away when I was only a boy.
My father, killed because of my mother.
When would it end?
He realized Sonika was still staring at him, awaiting an answer.
"Yes. My people are all I have left."
"Well, now you have us, too."
Voices were starting to rise up behind them, murmurs of confusion along the procession, wondering why they'd stopped. Jai turned to face the curious faces, immediately to his rear.
"We must walk into the darkness in order to find the light," he said. "There is a rope on the side. Hold on to it. Don't let go until you're through. We'll be safe inside. Pass this message along."
As soon as he'd finished, he heard the others begin to recite his words back through the throng. Each time it was repeated, his words grew a little fainter, until they vanished completely.
"Your words carry the command of a master," Sonika said.
The other Tears had already disappeared into the tunnel, leading their horses.
"They obey you without question."
He didn't like what she was implying.
"They obey because they choose to."
Sonika raised her hands in the air.
"I meant no offense. You are no master, not like the others."
"Then what am I?"
Jai wanted to ask.
Instead, he said, "I will stay here to help my people until they are all through."
"I expected nothing less," Sonika said,
and then plunged into the dark. 14. The Western Kingdom, the Crimean Sea, somewhere west of the Dead Isles. Grey Aris. The men on the ship treated Grey like a wart on one of their toes, sneering at him, purposely trying to trip him, laughing as he retched over the side of the rocking vessel. It didn't help that he was useless as a deckhand. His right hand was a traitor, fumbling the ropes, weak, clumsy.
"Why did I favour my left hand for so many years?"
he often wondered, staring at the infected stump that ended just above where his wrist should have been. The Furies had taken much more than his hand. They'd taken his spirit and self-confidence. For the most part, he managed to keep his head down and go about his work. He couldn't wait to be off the Junker, even if it meant coming face to face with the Fury who'd cut off his hand. He knew it would all be worth it if he found his sister. Most of the time, the only job he could do was scrubbing the deck. He had a love-hate relationship with his scrub brush. In a way, the only hours he enjoyed while on the boat were when he could lose himself in his thoughts, scrubbing the rough wood over and over again, the sun filtering through the clouds and warming his skin. It was the time he could think of his sister, Shay, picture her face in his mind's eye, make her real, make her alive. And yet he hated the scrubbing, because afterwards his muscles would scream at him, his back aching, his knees bruised, his arm as limp as a string of boiled cabbage leaves. And that's when Shay would be taken all over again by the Furia. For days and days at sea, he'd racked his brain for answers, trying to figure out why the Holy Warriors would kidnap his sister. She bore a sin mark, after all, and should have been killed immediately. That was the way of the West. Of course, Grey was glad the fierce red-haired women had chosen to be merciful. But that didn't change the fact that they could be doing worse things to her. Torturing, or tormenting, or... He jammed his eyes shut, biting his lip, trying to erase the awful thoughts from his head. He opened his eyes. The spot he'd just finished polishing was so clean he could see a faint reflection of himself in it, which, of course, only made the rest of the wooden planks look all the dirtier. His dark hair was long and messy, his eyes tired blue orbs, his cheeks and chin rough with a fortnight's worth of unshaven stubble.
"What do they want with you, Shay?"
he whispered to his reflection.
"Who's Shay?"
a voice said, startling him away from thoughts of his sister. A set of warm brown eyes peered at him from behind an old fish barrel. The girl's skin was naturally dark, her hair a series of salt-crusted ringlets. She was young, like Grey, perhaps 15 or 16. Grey thought he'd seen everyone on the small ship, but he had most definitely not seen this girl. In fact, she was the first member of the fairer sex he'd seen since they'd sailed from the walled city of Talis. Grey said nothing, looking away from her and back down at the decks. Whoever this girl was, she was not part of his plan to find his sister.
"Shay's a pretty name. Was she your lover?"
Grey cringed. A bold question.
"Does this girl have no filter?"
"She is no one. I was just speaking nonsense." She took the denial in stride, pointing at his left arm.
"That doesn't look good. It's infected."
"I know."
"I could help you. I've tended some of the men's wounds before."
Grey stared at the stump, which was once again leaking greyish-green liquid through the bandages. He knew he needed help, or he would lose the rest of his arm. He thought maybe it was already too late.
"Thank you." "Your name is Grey, right?"
Grey honestly didn't know anymore. When he'd been confident to a fault, bordering on arrogant, a smug thief who'd seduced a princess, the name Grease Jolly had felt right. When he lost his hand and his sister and Princess Rhea all in one foul swoop, he knew he would never be that slick city boy again. Did that make him Grey Aris again? Somehow he didn't feel worthy of that name, either. "I guess," he said, biting his tongue. Why was he answering her questions?
"That's a strange answer to a simple question."
"It's the only one I've got." She closed one eye, as if contemplating him under a magnifying glass, and then nodded to herself.
"Aye, you're Grey, all right. Did you know the other men mock you mercilessly, even when you're not around?"
Her question was so direct that he almost laughed, as if he wouldn't know. He nodded. "It seems I am the butt of many an ill joke on this voyage." The girl smiled.
"I suppose I should thank you, then. You've given me a reprieve."
"How do you figure?"
"They've been so focused on mocking you, they've forgotten to mock me."
Now Grey really did laugh. "I'm glad I've served a purpose of sorts. Well, other than cleaning the same decks again and again." Her smile broadened.
"I'm Kyla, daughter of the captain."
Grey's mouth gaped open as he considered her more closely. By his estimation, this girl looked nothing like the grey-whiskered Captain Smithers, though their skin was a similar shade. "I wouldn't think the sailors would mock the daughter of their captain. Not if they wanted to keep their employment." Her smile faded.
"My father is the worst of all. The last 8 months have been... hard."
Grey cocked his head to the side. "What was different about the last 8 months?" She shifted slightly, grimacing, and more of her body was exposed from behind the barrel.
"Oh, oh!"
Though she was a small girl with a small frame, her belly was so round and protruding she might have had a small barrel tucked under her grey frock. She was so big with child she looked ready to pop at any moment.
"But who is the father?"
Grey asked. As soon as the question left his lips, he knew it was rude.
"'Tis a very good question," a booming voice answered. "But mayhaps you shouldn't ask the lying whore-child."
Grey whipped around. Captain Smithers stood over him, holding a long wooden staff he never seemed to be without. Gray flinched back when the captain feigned a blow, and then laughed. The captain turned his attention to his daughter.
"Girl, why are ye above decks? I thought I made myself clear you were not to parade yourself around like a festival sideshow."
The girl's, Kyla's, statement came back to Gray. "My father is the worst of all." "She was only making conversation," Gray said. "No trouble at all. I'll just be on my way. Got more decks to clean before the day is done." Awkwardly, he tried to push himself to his feet with one hand. He still hadn't quite gotten the hang of it. The captain stuck his staff between Gray's legs, and he toppled over, banging his knee and shoulder, crying out in pain. Suddenly Smithers' face was right next to Gray's, so close he could see the tobacco stains between the captain's teeth.
"Don't speak to me daughter again, you hear?"
"Father," Kyla said,
but he shoved her away. Gray didn't want to speak to her again, especially not if it made trouble for both of them.
"Yes, Captain."
"Aye, Captain,"
Smithers roared.
"Aye, Captain,"
Gray repeated.
"And ye stay below decks, or I'll chain ye to the brig,"
he hollered at Kyla, stomping over to her and grabbing her by the hair. She cried out as he pulled her away. Gray just watched, hating himself more and more for not helping the poor pregnant girl. Then again, maybe she'd created her own problems just as he had, and now she had to live with her decisions. Still, he felt sorry for her, and wished he could do something. But he couldn't risk it. If he helped her now, the captain might decide he didn't need Gray to scrub the decks any more, and then Shay would have no one to come and find her. So he gritted his teeth, breathed deeply, and went back to scrubbing, until the sun turned red on the horizon, the waters darkened, and Gray's palm was so raw it burned. It had been 3 days since the incident with the captain's daughter. Already the memory had grown fuzzy around the edges, falling into the category of things that don't matter. Right? This voyage was all about finding his sister. And anyway, he had no right to intercede in relations between father and daughter. And yet, every time Kyla's memory began to fade, Gray would find himself thinking about the way her belly had protruded like a ripe melon, how she'd been the first one on the ship to smile at him, to ask about his sister, to seem to care. Then he remembered the way she'd cried out in pain as her father dragged her away by the hair, and how he'd ignored it, pretending it wasn't happening. He realized he was no longer scrubbing the deck, but banging the wooden back of the brush against it. Thud, thud, thud.
"Oi, cripple! Keep it down, will you?"
one of the seamen hollered. He was doing real work, lashing the sails to a pole, angling the billowing canvas so it would catch the wind just right, helping to move the ship closer to where his sister had supposedly gone, to the Dead Isles. Gray muttered an apology and went back to scrubbing. His infected stump was getting worse, throbbing and stinging. Another 3 days passed before he saw Kyla again. He was passing by the captain's quarters, heading for the bunk rooms, when the door flew open with a bang.
"Don't test me, girl!"
the captain shouted. Inside, someone was crying, and Gray could just make out a round form hunched on the floor, her face covered by her hands. As if Gray didn't exist, the captain slammed the door shut and stormed past, muttering,
"Her ma would roll over in her grave. Aye, she would."
Gray stood stock still for a moment, listening to the muffled sobbing. Slowly, he raised the heel of his hand to his head, pressing it into his skull.
"Keep going. Just keep going. Not your problem. Not your fight."
He took a step away, and then stopped.
"God's damn it!
I must be the biggest fool in the Four Kingdoms." He turned and opened the door, hissing, "Kyla," before stepping inside. The girl's crying stopped, and she turned, her wet eyes peering between curled locks of brown hair. Her hands immediately went to her belly, rubbing it through her clothes. It was like some kind of an instinct.
"Gray,"
she said.
I wanted to..." Why couldn't he get the words out?
"Don't speak to me, daughter, again, you hear?"
If he finished this sentence, was he risking his sister's life? If the captain found him in his quarters now, Gray knew it wouldn't matter either way. He'd already crossed a line, and he might as well take advantage of it. I wanted to make sure you were unhurt.
You did?
Aye.
Thank you. And I'm not hurt. He didn't touch me, not with his hands. Only with his words.
What words?
Whore. Charlatan. No good lass.
Gray was sorry he'd asked, though he was puzzled by one of the insults. Why charlatan? The girl flinched, as if the word was a wasp that had stung her cheeks.
He says I'm no longer his daughter, that I'm an impostor, a fraud. That his daughter died when my mother...
She blinked away tears, dashing the few that escaped her eyes with the back of her hand.
Thank you for coming here, Gray, but you should go. If he finds you talking to me again, he will think the worst.
What did she mean? What was the worst? It dawned on him. Oh, gods! He would never. She was younger than him, and 8 months pregnant, and...
If you ever need anything, come find me, he said.
He left, closing the door behind him. He stood there for a moment, breathing, just breathing, mentally berating himself for making such a foolish offer. Thankfully, another week passed without him seeing the captain's daughter. Perhaps she forgot about what I said, or didn't take it seriously. Perhaps she isn't a fool like me. Or maybe she just doesn't need me. He tried to forget about her, cleaning out his wound thrice a day, but it didn't seem to make a difference. Pus kept leaking out. It was hurting more and more each day, and he was finding it harder to perform his scrubbing duties. Then, one day when he'd finished his work, he was looking over the bow of the ship at the endless sea of blue, gnawing on a hunk of crusty brown bread and nibbling on pickled sardines. The sea was a mirror, as calm and glassy as he'd ever seen it. The sky, the clouds, and the sun were all reflected in the blue-grey waters, and Gray could almost imagine that if he jumped, he might fall either up or down, the probability in equal proportion, like the flip of a golden coin tumbling end over end, never landing. He was just contemplating what that might mean when he heard a voice.
Psst! Gray!
At first he couldn't figure out where the whisper was coming from. He looked up at the crow's nest, but his gaze only drew a well-aimed wad of spit from the watchman in the tower. As he wiped the spittle from his cheek with his shirt sleeve, a melodious giggle arose, not from above, but from below. He stared down into the churning, white-capped ocean, wondering whether the infection in his stump had travelled to his brain, addling his mind.
"No, you buffoon! Down here!"
Gray leaned over further, his gaze travelling down the curving wooden planks of the barnacle-riddled bow, to the figurehead at the front, a rusting sea-green statue of a naked woman with a long fishtail. And perched atop the statue's head, her legs crossed underneath her, was Kyla, the wind whipping through her curls, billowing her grey frock all around her, revealing a large portion of her smooth brown thighs. Gray immediately feared for her. Being big with child, surely her balance would be thrown off. At any moment she could topple over, and then she'd be gone, lost beneath the waves. And yet she seemed perfectly at ease, both hands resting lightly against the side of the ship.
"Give me your hand," Gray said, reaching down. "I'll help you back on deck." "Why did you offer to help me?"
Kyla asked. Gray didn't have an answer, because he didn't truly know himself, but he replied,
"I'll tell you after we're safe on deck. I like it better down here. Down here I don't have to be me."
The words were like knives piercing Gray's chest, not because of how awful they were, but because he understood them. It was why he'd changed his name and disappeared into a big city like Night's End. To start over. To be someone else.
"What happened to your mother?"
Gray asked. Again, the words were out of his mouth before he could consider whether it was rude of him to ask such a personal question. Kyla looked away, her stare trained out at sea as the wind whipped her hair and dress around her. Gray was sorry he'd asked, fearing he'd made her cry. But when she looked back up at him, her eyes were dry, her expression fierce.
"She died, and my father died with her."
Before he could consider how to respond, or if he should respond, she clambered over the side of the statue, vanishing into a hole in the hull. Gray and his family, his Ma, his Da, and Shay, were living in Restor at the time, a traveller's town on the Western Road, halfway from the Bridge of Triumph to Night's End. One day the Furies themselves rode through the town, their red robes flowing behind them, their long silver swords flashing. A young boy, Gray was enamoured by their energy, how they seemed to command attention from all who looked upon them. His parents were scared. "Get inside," they said to Gray and Shay. "Hurry!" They peeked through the windows as the Furies went house to house looking for something, or someone. 5 houses away? 4. They were carrying torches, though it was not yet dark. "Son," Gray's Da said to him, "protect your sister above all else."
"I will, father,"
Gray said, although he didn't really understand what was happening.
"We need to show you something,"
his Ma said, using tongs to extract an ember from the hearth.
"Give me your hand, Shay."
Shay didn't hesitate. At only 5, she already wasn't scared of anything. Her mother brought the ember close to the palm of her tiny hand, which immediately bloomed with golden light. A strange shape took form, the lines curling into a crown, and then extending to a spindle, which was broken at the end. His sister's eyes were huge as she stared at the glowing mark. Gray felt a shiver of fear race through him.
"No!"
He wanted to scream.
"Not her. Why her?"
In that moment, he knew exactly what sort of people the Furies were looking for. They called those that bore sin marks demons, and now Gray knew his sister was one of them. But he didn't see it that way. She was a pure spirit, his best friend. And she was only a child, while he'd had his 8th name day and was becoming a man grown. His Da's words pulsed through his skull. "Protect your sister above all else, else."
"We have to leave,"
Gray said, suddenly understanding.
"Yes,"
his Ma nodded, tears shimmering in her eyes. That's when Gray knew she wasn't coming with them. "Through the back window," his Da said. "We'll follow just behind you." It was the only lie his Da ever told him. The only thing that followed them was the sound of the Furies breaking down their door and the shouts of a struggle. And then nothing. Gray awoke screaming, thrashing at the knotted sheets tangled around his body. His stump was pounding like a blacksmith's hammer on an anvil. A hand burst through the dark, snapping across his face.
"Shut your crippled trap," a voice said. "Some of us are trying to sleep."
It was one of the deckhands, leaning over the top bunk. Gray stopped shouting before the sailor chose to hit him again.
"Sorry," he muttered. "I need some air."
He untangled himself from the sheets, balling them up and stuffing them next to his pillow. Then he stumbled above decks, where the salty ocean air immediately stung his nostrils. He stared up at the sky, which was clear and dark, speckled with more stars than he'd ever seen in his life. He wondered whether the Western belief in the 7th heaven was real, and, if so, whether his parents were there now, looking down on him from the red, green, and gold stars. He hoped not. Because, if so, they would know of his failures, his weaknesses. They would know that his only friend was a pregnant girl, and that he'd broken his promise and been unable to protect Shay. The longer he stared at the night sky, the more the stars seemed to form shapes, most of which were random patterns and designs, until he saw it. A mark. A golden crown, connected to a shiny, narrow spindle, which extended outwards. Though he'd only seen it once, the memory of Shay's mark was etched in his mind forever. Her mark ended partway along the spindle, almost as if it had been cut off before it could be finished. To this day, neither Gray nor Shay knew what power her mark gave her, a fact that had never really bothered him until now. But now he could see the rest of the mark, formed by the stars above. The spindle continued further, ending when a rectangular piece stuck from the bottom. Gray's breath hung in the air, his unblinking eyes stinging. The mark wasn't a crown and spindle at all. No. It was a key. A key for what?
I'm just being a fool, like usual, Gray thought as he walked along the deck.
He'd finished his work for the day and was too tired to be hungry, and too hungry to be tired. It was certainly one or the other. But neither hunger nor weariness mattered right now. All that mattered was what he'd seen in the stars.
I saw nothing, he reminded himself. I'm no star reader.
Shay's mark could be a key, but it could also be some kind of a scepter, or a hairpin, or a pointless trinket given to a child. And yet he couldn't get the key out of his mind, how it sparkled with possibility. A scream shattered what was left of the day, freezing Gray in his tracks. It had sounded like a girl's scream, and there was only one girl Gray knew of on the ship. Kyla. The scream had been muffled by wood and distance, arising from somewhere below decks. Gray rushed toward the stairs, jostling for position amongst the other seamen, who were doing the same thing.
"Watch it, cripple," one of them warned.
The scream fell away, and now there was a lower, different sound, somewhere between a groan and moan. Gray tried to push through the men, who were packed shoulder to shoulder.
"Pathetic girl," someone said. "Roth is punishing her for her sins," another decided.
Gray's heart was in his throat, but still he fought his way forward. Some of the men were already turning around and heading back up top, even before the captain's booming voice rang out.
"Let this be a lesson to you all. Your sins will always bury ye in the end. Now move along. Leave the whore child be."
More men turned, elbowing and shouldering Gray as they passed, but he barely felt the hits. And then, abruptly, he was alone in the narrow corridor, staring into the captain's quarters. The captain's frame filled the doorway, but Gray was looking past him, through the narrow gap. The first thing he noticed was Kyla, collapsed on the floor. The strange, guttural, almost animal-like noise was coming from her. The second thing he noticed was all the blood. 15. Unknown location. The beggar. He awoke to whispers, which were, at first, as unascertainable as the sound of the wind, but which slowly came into focus.
"Four dead. Four dead. Four left. Four. Only four. Then peace. Death, then peace. My fate. Mine alone. Mine, mine, mine. Mine, 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 silence!"
The last word was the roar of a lion, echoing through the darkness and making the beggar flinch. And then,
"Are you awake?"
The beggar said nothing, racking his brain for anything that might explain his current plight. It all came back to him in a rush, being captured by the Empire, Empress Sands coming to him, plotting to use his plague against her enemies, and then the unexpected appearance of the shadowy boy who grabbed him, who pushed him, who made him kill her.
"Oh, gods, what have I done?"
the beggar thought. But it wasn't a thought. He'd spoken the words aloud.
"Not you," the voice said. "Me. You were just a tool. I am the king's bane. But you can help me."
"How?"
The question came out before he could stop it. The bearer of the voice shuffled closer. The beggar blinked, his eyes adjusting to the murk, which was turning grey. He was garbed in a thick cloth, the boy's cloak, he remembered. He could just make out the curve of a hairless, pale scalp and the young boy attached to it. The boy seemed to be shaking slightly, his entire body trembling.
"Don't come any closer," the beggar said. "I'm dangerous."
Bane ignored his warning and moved closer still.
"You're not the dangerous one," he hissed. "The kings and queens and emperors and empresses are the dangerous ones. Their pointless wars result in thousands of deaths. I only want eight, and then the violence can stop. We can have peace."
"But how do you choose?"
The beggar had never been able to choose. Death came to him like flies on feces.
"The ruler in each kingdom must die, as well as their true heir."
The beggar frowned in the dark, rocking his body to sit up. Pale orbs stared at him, too close for comfort. He crab-walked back three paces.
But what if the ruler isn't a warmonger? Or what if their heir wants peace?
They are all warmongers,
Vane screamed. The beggar was so shocked by the force of the outburst that he fell backwards.
What do you want from me?
Vane staggered and then fell to his knees, shaking even harder. He breathed deeply for a few moments, as if trying to gather his strength before responding.
I want you to be my partner. I want you to be my friend.
The boy's tone had changed. He sounded so young, so innocent, not like the killer he was. Then again, the beggar heard a bit of himself in the boy. Vane crawled closer, still shaking.
I don't fear you like the others. We could be brothers. On my own, I can cleanse the kingdom of those who would destroy it, but it will be a slow process. I grow weak each time I use my powers. Exhausted. I sleep for days, sometimes weeks. But you, if you help me, it will change everything. Peace will dawn upon the four kingdoms before winter comes. Here, take my hand.
The beggar shrank back from the ghost-like fingers that darted through the gloom.
No, you'll die. Wait,
wait. Perhaps that would be best.
Yes, he could kill this murderous boy and then die himself. Would that redeem him?
No, he knew. But still, it would be better.
I'm wearing gloves. Thick ones.
The gloved hand grabbed his before he could squirm away. The fingers squeezed, and Bane's face eased closer until he could feel the boy's breath on his face.
Now we are one in purpose. Swear it.
I...
Even through the gloves, Bane's hand felt warm in his. The human contact was like nothing he'd ever felt. For once, there was no fear, no shame, no regret. Just a connection between two people. Two would-be strangers. Was this boy really seeking peace? And if so, could he truly be a part of something so important, so noble? He had nothing left to live for, except perhaps this.
I swear it, he said.
On what do you swear?
The beggar didn't worship the gods, not really. He had no friends, no possessions. But he had a past. He'd once had a family, a mother, a father, an aunt, a name.
I swear on my mother's memory.
Who was she?
Vane asked. An enormous chasm opened up in his chest, sucking everything into it. His heart. His soul. His past, his present, but maybe not his future.
The first person I killed, he said.
It was the first time he'd said the truth out loud. It was warm and dark and quiet. Vane was sleeping, his steady exhalations as soothing as a mother's lullaby. And yet the beggar didn't feel tired at all. His mind was moving too fast, like thunder rolling over the open water. Occasionally lightning flashed, splitting his head in two. Two more deaths, and then it would be over. That was one option.
Touch Bane and then kill yourself.
Quick. Easy. In the dark, he crept toward the first person to ever call him friend. Brother. The first one to consider his mark a talent rather than a curse.
If you help me, it will change everything. Peace will dawn upon the four kingdoms before winter comes.
He stopped. He'd sworn on his mother's memory that he would help Bane. And the boy's cause was important, grand, real. It was true. The four kingdoms were never going to stop fighting. Thousands more would die.
What if he could help stop it?
What if he could do something good for once in his life? But did killing really bring about peace? Shouldn't it be the opposite? His hand hovered over Bane's face. He could feel the plague humming along the surface of his skin, probing, searching, hungry for another victim. Hungry for human flesh and blood and bone to feast on.
Just touch him. Simple. And then be free.
Closer.
closer.
End him! End him! End him!
A tremor shook his hand, and he almost brushed Bane's cheek, his fingers so close he could feel the heat coming off the boy's pale skin. He pulled away, breathing heavily, shivering despite the warmth. No, he wouldn't kill his only friend, his new brother.
"Where are we going?"
he said to himself.
"What are we doing?"
Bane shifted in his sleep, but his eyes remained closed. His lips parted.
"The Southron gates," he murmured. "We have an army to infect."
16. The Southern Empire, Calip. Raven Sands. The arena was nestled between the three pyramids. At the apex of each pyramid, a single blue eye was painted, and seemed to stare down on the gathering, like silent, godlike spectators. They represented the three most powerful Southron deities, Eero, the sky goddess, Osha, the sea god, and Crag, goddess of the land. The arena itself was a circle of empty dust ringed by a tall, thick wall, meant to keep the action in a confined area and protect the Calypsians, who sat on the stone steps that rose 100 high in every direction. Thousands had thronged to the arena earlier that morning. It had been 8 years since the rule of Calip had been decided in the arena, and they weren't about to miss it. Now the sun rose high and hot overhead, and most of the spectators wore hooded cloaks to keep the heat off of their skin, fanning themselves with thick sheaves of parchment or carrigal leaves. They were growing antsy, and most were ready for blood. Raven stood in the exact center of the arena with the Shiva, waiting. It was just like fire to be late, forcing her to look like the fool, standing under the sweltering glare of the sun goddess, Sarai. Beneath Raven's black battle leathers, she sweated profusely. Last night there were sisters in grief. Today there were rivals in battle. A cheer rose up as a figure rode from one of the gates forged into the wall. Fire was garbed in her battle leathers, painted red with flames. Her crimson hair was spiked to a point atop her head. She raised her hand in the air, letting tendrils of flame stretch up to the tip of her sword. The enormous Guanic she rode didn't even flinch. He was her usual mount and was used to her fiery antics. "Gods," Raven thought. "If the battle could be won before it was fought, I'd be waving a white flag." Fire did a full lap around the arena, milking the crowd for all it was worth, and it was worth quite a lot by the sounds of their roars and whistles. Even if Raven won, they'd clamour for fire afterwards. Raven began clapping slowly as her sister finally approached.
"Good show, sister," she said. "I'm just giving our people what they want," Fire said. "Perhaps you should try it yourself. You think they want war? You think they want to die in the desert? I think they want to be strong. I can show them the way."
Raven shook her head. There was no arguing with Fire, and anyway, there was no point. Only one of them would rule, and today's spectacle would decide whom.
"You can still retreat with grace," Fire said with a smirk.
She coaxed her Guanic right up to Raven, until their noses were practically touching. The beast opened its mouth to reveal several sets of razor-sharp teeth. It roared with such force that Raven's braided hair shifted behind her. Raven didn't move, refusing to let her sister get the best of her in front of her people.
"So can you," she said into the Guanic's mouth.
The reptilian creature snapped at her, but then backed away upon command from its rider. Fire laughed.
"You are a worthy opponent, sister, but it won't change the result. I shall be Empress, and you shall obey me."
Leaving Raven with that to chew on, Fire turned away as the Shiva raised a hand to silence the crowd. The raucous applause ceased, and the multitude of voices died down to a muted rumble. Before the Shiva could begin the ceremony, Fire's Guanic roared once more, which made the audience flare up in pockets of excitement. Raven knew it was no accident. Nothing her sister did was an accident. The Shiva finally spoke.
"On this day in the 532nd year since the Crimean invaders reached our western shores, the rule of Calip shall be decided in combat.
More cheers, the excitement palpable, crackling like lightning.
The contest shall be between Raven Sands, the first daughter of our beloved Empress Sun Sands, and Fire Sands, the second daughter. May the worthiest Sands emerge the victor.
The crowd whipped itself into a frenzy. Fire riled them up further by tossing her fiery sword from one hand to the other. Raven just stood there, watching it all, waiting for the Shiva to clear the field of battle. He climbed a ladder over the wall, and then pulled it up behind him. Once the battle began, none would be able to escape the dust bowl until it was over. Fire turned toward her. Her guanic pawed in the dirt. Raven said, "You would fight mounted while I am on foot. A cowardly move, sister."
"Victory is victory,"
Fire said, and then she charged. Raven didn't move, watching as the powerful beast galloped closer and closer, its scaly skin undulating as its muscles flexed and released. Fire's jaw was set, her blade at the ready. Raven had seen that look of determination many times in training, and rarely did she lose.
"Get ready," Raven thought.
The guanic raced toward her, and Fire swung her blade. At the last possible moment, Raven dove to the side. She felt the wind from the beast's body as it swept past, felt the heat of her sister's sword as it narrowly missed her leather-padded shoulder. She rolled once, letting her momentum carry her back to her feet. Drawing her own weapon, a black, barbed whip, she whirled around to follow her sister's guanic as it skidded, turned, and charged once more. That's when she felt the heat on the back of her neck. She grabbed her braid and snuffed out the fire with her fingers, but she'd already lost almost a quarter of her hair from Fire's flaming sword. Her hand was burned and charred black, but Raven forced herself to ignore the pain throbbing in her palm. She snapped her whip with deadly precision, letting it uncoil to its full length, wrapping around the guanic's two front legs. With a jerk of her wrist, she yanked it back as hard as she could. When the barbs sank deep into the huge creature's flesh, its momentum was almost enough to rip Raven's shoulder from its socket, but she managed to dig her feet into the dirt and hang on. The creature's legs snapped together, and the guanic stumbled, tripped, and fell, howling headfirst into the dirt. Fire spun in the air, tucking into a somersault, still clutching her sword, which rotated in a fiery arc. With incredible grace, she landed lithely on her feet, grinning.
"Well played, dear sister. It seems we are on equal footing once more."
The guanic groaned, and Raven felt bad for the poor beast. She tossed her whip aside. It would take time and effort to unbury the barbs from the reptile's skin and muscle. Fortunately, she was prepared, uncoiling another whip from her belt. She had two others, if necessary. As the sisters faced each other, the Shiva stood high on the wall and shouted,
"Prepare!"
It was the standard command for such an event, and basically meant, get ready for something that's going to try to kill you. Although the main goal of this event was to defeat her sister, it wouldn't be just her she was fighting. No, not even close. Beneath their feet, metal clanked, as spiked chains emerged from where they'd been hidden beneath the dust. Raven danced back, but she was too slow. One of the spikes grazed her leg, tearing through her leathers and drawing a thin line of blood across her calf. Pain shot through her, but it was a mere flesh wound. She would survive to fight on. Fire had avoided the initial chain trap, but had gone in the wrong direction. Now the moving chains had her surrounded, tightening their spiked noose as she whirled around, trying to find an exit where there was none. Raven said, "Do you submit?" Fire laughed, which didn't surprise Raven one bit. Her sister hated to lose more than anything else. Nothing but death or unconsciousness would end this contest if Raven were to win. The chains whipped closer, their spikes narrowly missing Fire's face. She ducked one, jumped another, and then did a front handspring away from the danger. Defeated, the chains were drawn back across the field of battle by whomever was controlling them, and settled against the wall. A dull roar of appreciation arose from the audience. Raven slung her whip forward, but Fire made no effort to avoid it. Reaching the end of its length, the barbed end cracked a mere finger breadth in front of Fire's face before retreating.
"Of course," Raven mused.
"Fire knows exactly how long each of my whips are. I'll have to be more creative." The next time she slung her whip, she released its handle, letting it slither through the air like a flying snake. Fire recognized the change in tactic a moment too late, but managed to turn her head and take the blow in the shoulder.